This is The End User, episode 167 for Wednesday, April 16th, The Swiping Way. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr. Chris, we had last week off because I was on vacation, and yesterday you were on vacation, and now we're back, and I feel like that there's some important stuff that we got to talk about.
Yeah, so we're going to change the format of the show just a little bit because we've had so much news in the week that we've had off that our ledger is just overflowing. So we're going to drop some of the kind of unimportant stuff off the bottom, and we're going to talk about some of the stuff that really matters. And we're going to lead off here with something that is a very technical issue and has been very challenging to explain to the public for many people, and that is the Heartbleed bug. Have you heard of this, Taylor?
Yeah, I've heard of it, and I was really confused when I first heard about it because all I was seeing was what people were saying on Twitter, and I just was hearing crazy and conflicting and panicking reports.
Yep.
160 characters at a time, and I just started to get really confused, and I had to do a lot of reading before I calmed down and started to get a grasp on what I had read that was true and what wasn't.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of your first reaction to seeing this news come across the wire is that, oh, the sky is falling down on the internet. Get out!
Right.
But yeah, we've gotten a chance to step back and take a little better look at it. And it's actually not so bad as we first thought it was.
Right. So what is the technical heart of the Heartbleed bug?
Right. So at the there's a lot to this, and what's troubling is the statistics around it. So basically, any website that decided to use SSL, and for anyone who's unfamiliar with the term SSL, we've talked about it before, of course, but this is what provides verification that the server you're talking to is in fact the server that is identified as itself. And it provides encryption from your machine to that machine so that you can go to Facebook.com or whatever and have a little bit of privacy. So it gets you two things. It gets you, you are assured that you are in fact going to one of Facebook's servers when you go to Facebook.com, and you are assured that anyone viewing your connection from the outside does not have the ability to listen into those communications in any way because it's encrypted, right?
Right.
So what the 10-mile view of Heartbleed is that a very popular open source library that implemented SSL had a bug in it that would allow an arbitrary person to send a request, a packet, to the server and extract a little bit of memory from it. So basically what that means from the 10-mile perspective is you cannot be guaranteed that anything that was contained in the server's memory is in fact secret. And we have a shared secret to negotiate the encryption and get the privacy and the authentication. And that potentially, very, very conservatively, is completely out the window when you look at Heartbleed. But the reality is that it's not really quite that bad.
Right. So you said that a person can send a packet request in order to get a little bit of the memory. So they're just basically getting a random info dump from whatever on the memory at the time, right?
Right. And I believe it was either 64K or 128K. I think it's 64K. But
yeah, 64.
Basically, you get this tiny, teeny, tiny little bit of memory. And if somebody who is exploiting this got lucky, then they would be able to extract the shared secret between you and the server. And as a consequence, you can't really guarantee that your conversation with that server is in fact still protected via SSL.
Right, but they can only do this a tiny little piece of the memory at the time, and they can't
right.
target it. But they can do it as many times as they want. So
yes.
That's where the statistics start to come in.
And what's scary is, for the most part, the server owner just has no idea that it happened. there typically aren't logging protocols involved in that low level of a activity. So typically most sites who were vulnerable to this bug just don't know that they were exploited or not. So they can't say with certainty that they hadn't leaked their secret information. So the bug affects, like I said, it's the OpenSSL, open source SSL implementation. And what that means is that any site who uses that in conjunction with Apache and the Nginx web servers are going to be vulnerable. So that happens to be somewhere on the order of like a fourth of the internet. You know, it's just, it's hard to tell what, there are many numbers floating around on how much of the internet was involved in this, but it's a very, very large chunk, somewhere around a quarter, maybe a little less, maybe a little more.
Right. Well, some sources are reporting that there are as many as a million internet servers that had been affected and possibly could have been affected since 2011.
Right. So this bug is 2 years old at this point, and no one noticed.
On top of that, there are many Android phones that are susceptible to this as well.
That's right. So it's a little bit less of a concern because it's a lesser attack vector. But it is the case that in devices that use OpenSSL, Android, some Android versions amongst them, have the ability to be pinged and get that little random bit of memory. So I don't know. It's a little less of a concern, but it still is there, I suppose. But you're really talking about the server communications and lesser so the client implementations like smartphones and that kind of thing.
Right. And so, all right, now we know how the bug works and roughly how many people it affects, or at least how many websites it affects. And they're saying that at least a third have been patched already, and so there are somewhere between 200,000 and 600,000 servers that are still vulnerable. But the real problem is someone who has been trying to exploit this vulnerability for a long time and continuing to accrue unencrypted data from the memory to try to find personal information, right? And so someone's got to dig through all of that arbitrary code to see if they can find that.
Right, and we've got a little bit of data about this now that we didn't have when this bug first came out. And what we have seen is that the people who discovered the bug set up a bunch of honeypots to see if just being on the public internet was that there was someone on the public internet that was scanning the entire internet for servers that were vulnerable to this. And they were unable to find that. So as far as our best guess goes about this, and that's all it's going to be a guess, is that this was previously unknown, and if it was known, it was only used for targeted attacks. So in other words, there was no one before the disclosure of this bug that was scanning the entire internet just looking for servers to exploit. So we can at least say that much. So, okay, should we back up and get into what exactly people should do about this? We've covered how it works. We've covered kind of the scope of, you know, who's affected and when. Let's get into what we should do about this as end users.
Sure, yeah.
And so my advice is this is something that is of seriously an edge case. So if you want to be as 100% conservative about this, any site that you were logged on to in the past 2 years while this bug was in place, you cannot 100% guarantee that your particular credentials at that site are not compromised. So if you have been logged into a site for the last 2 years, then you cannot guarantee that. But I would just kind of back up a little bit, and because you're not going to go crazy and change all of your hundreds of passwords across the entire internet, right?
Probably not. I mean, some people might want to.
Yeah,
but it's not necessary for everybody.
The Edward Snowdens of the world, who really have to worry about their privacy and take a ton of care to encrypt their communications, they're going to be a little bit more worried than your average person. But for all of us, us average people who don't quite know what to do about this, I would say that at very least what you should go do is change your banking passwords and change sites that you are logged into regularly. So I would go change, for me, that would be, I would go change Outlook.com, I would change Facebook, I would change Twitter, and I would change my banking accounts. And for you, it would probably be the same combination of things, but with Gmail thrown in, right?
Right. Now, my first question when I heard about this was, how does two-factor authentication change the security scenario in these breaches? And what I found after a lot of digging is that it's still possible for the two-factor code to be found in the Heartbleed data. But it's a lot less likely that that information can be exploited.
You are practically safe if you were using two-factor, I think, because you would have to leak not only the credential, you would have to leak the key to the two-factor auth. It's just that is increasingly unlikely, although not 100% impossible, right?
Right. And so my Google account is protected by two-factor authentication using a code that changes every 6 seconds.
Right. So you have both your password and your two-factor token.
Right.
So in that case, you're probably fine, although if you wanted to be conservative, you'd still change it.
Right.
It depends on your tolerance to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I've changed the ones that I think need changing, but I'm pretty tolerant to this because I have the backups in place that I need, and two-factor authentication is one of those.
Right, right. So there's an interesting article that we've got on Mashable that I think people will like, and you'll have to go through. This list is way too long to read verbatim the whole thing, but they've got a list of sites that specify if the site was affected, and do you need to change your password for that site? And it's got a list of pretty much all of them. But like I said, the list almost doesn't matter. You just change the things that you use regularly and change your really important things like banking. And that's probably as far as you'll have to go. And even those sites were probably not leaking their credentials. I'd have to imagine that it was really only used in really targeted kind of situations. Although we know that as soon as the news of this bug hit the wire, hackers out there in the world were going out and scanning the internet looking for servers to exploit.
Right.
But the surface area of the attack is just so small that it's hard to recommend that you change all of your passwords. But so anyway, they've got a chart, if you are concerned about that, of all of the sites and how they're affected. And, you know, I think a lot of these, there's some good information about Facebook and Twitter and Apple and Google, you know, all the big technology players. But what worries me a little bit are the financial institutions on there, because they all seem to be unaffected in a way that seems suspicious to me.
Right. So they're saying they're unaffected.
Right. That is what they have communicated to their customers, at very least. So the worst thing that I read on the list was fileyourtaxes.com, which I've never used. But they say, we continuously patch our servers to keep them updated. However, the version we use was not affected by the issue, so no action was taken. And that doesn't really make any sense, because there is only a 2-year period in which this bug was even in place. So, in other words, there was some code introduced 2 years ago that caused this bug, and it was fixed just recently. So it's been around for 2 years. So either they were 2 years out of date and were not affected, or they were updating their servers and they were more recent than 2 years and they were affected. So that statement doesn't really hold water. You know, I'm not saying they're lying. They could be using some other library or something like that, but it's troublesome to me that a lot of the financial and government institutions are just are not willing to be communicative about whether they were affected and if they have fixed it. Because it's really something that you should be in an open conversation with your users about, and you should let them know. So just to see across the board all of the financial institutions just say, oh, nope, we weren't affected, no way. is just a little strange to me. I'm not saying they're lying about it, but it is certainly suspicious.
Right. I mean, to me, it points to the possibility of the fact that they don't understand the bug and the extent of the compromise.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'd have to imagine they have an engineer somewhere who knows what's going on. I can't imagine that they, you know, built the site and then sacked all the engineers or something like that. But whatever the case is, I feel like some of the institutions on the list are, their PR people are taking some liberties.
Yeah, that is what I was thinking too. The PR person has not talked to the right engineer.
Right, right. So
the best and simplest explanation for how Heartbleed is happening that I've come across on the internet was last week's XKCD comic.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Called How the Heartbleed Bug Works. And it breaks it down into pretty simple language, featuring a dialogue between a woman and a generic server.
And it basically shows you how, from the first packet sent, how this bug can leak that little bit of private information. In this example, they use 500 letters. And I think it really exemplifies what's going on there and kind of how it works without really getting into the technical details, right?
Right.
Of course, I guess if you're sitting there speaking to a server, like the cartoon is, you've probably got bigger problems.
Yeah, I definitely would not want to speak directly to a server, especially not after seeing 2001.
Yeah, I don't think they even have microphones. I hate to break it to you. It cannot hear you.
If Hal the server from Hal the computer from 2001 had Heartbleed, he might have been easier to defeat.
Yeah, maybe. So in the end, maybe this bug is a good thing.
Right. This is our back door against the machine.
All right. So just to kind of round out here, we'll say that any site in the last 2 years that you know you've been logged into and is on this list, you should probably think about changing your credentials. And then the very important sites that you know have high value, you should probably change your passwords. And I'm assuming at this point that all of the servers have changed their SSL certs. So if they were still exploitable, it wouldn't do much to change your password. But they're all, I'm assuming, just about all the major sites are fixed at this point in time. So if you were super conservative, I would go back and look at everything you've logged into in the past 2 years and change those. If you were a normal person like we are, I would change banking and email and other important sites that you use a lot. And that's probably where you can draw the line at.
Now, it's worth noting if you're using a website that has not updated or patched their servers and they are still affected, changing your password won't do all that much because it still remains vulnerable to an attack. Although, if the site had been vulnerable over the last 2 years and someone got your password at that point, they would still have to try a new attack in order to get the new password.
Right, right. And in the end, you know, it's not the end of the world. Here's a bug that is potentially very bad, but in practice seems not to be. So, you know, the world of privacy online is not completely on fire, and I wouldn't worry about it too much. It's just worth looking into those kind of high value targets that you know that you know, people who are trying to get identity theft going would be after, right?
Right. And they have lots of other ways of stealing identities.
Yeah, it's not exactly low-hanging fruit to exploit the server in that way. You know, they'd probably do better with a phishing scam at this point.
Now, one other thing worth noting is that if you use Google Chrome, the SSL servers that Chrome talks to whenever you visit a website usually have a certificate that is sent to the browser and stored on your computer, and Chrome by default doesn't verify the authenticity of
right.
those certificates. So you have to go into your settings in Chrome and enable the certificate verification process to make sure that your SSL server that your browser is communicating with still has a valid certificate, or whether it's been revoked because it's not secure.
Right, and basically we're at a point where everybody's certs are being rekeyed, so that becomes a little more important.
Right, so that is a simple setting that you can change in Chrome and will definitely make your browsing much more secure.
Yeah, and I'm going to imagine that after this happens, that Chrome and Firefox and Opera and Internet Explorer are all going to change their defaults, I'd have to imagine. But we don't know that yet, so we'll have to find out.
Right.
All right, well, we've bled that topic to death.
Ho-ho.
Hey-o. you get that one?
Yep, I got it.
All right. That was horrible. So let's move on into some Microsoft news. We've got the Build conference happening last week. We've got a ton of news coming out of Build. And I wanted to lead off with a little Windows Phone 8.1 news. So first off, if you are a Windows Phone 8 user and you would like to get Windows Phone 8.1, it's actually very simple. You can go into you can go to their developer site and sign up for a developer account for free and get the update as a faux developer. So it's going to be released later at the discretion of the carriers, of course, because they have to do whatever they have to do. I'm not sure what they do, but you can get it right now if you are so inclined. Just we've got a link in the show notes to a Paul Thurrott article in WinSuperSite that has the instructions on how exactly to go about doing that.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. So I'm hearing that Windows Phone 8.1 is pretty nice.
Yeah, Taylor, this is huge. This is one of these kind of updates that I know I've said this before. It's the largest little update that could possibly happen, right? So in other words, all of the updates in and of themselves are not that spectacular, but you roll all of them together and it's actually a pretty huge update that brings Windows Phone into line with the likes of Android and iOS in a way that I think that they were lagging behind a little bit before.
So it's a refinement update. It's like yes. When Apple does an update and they say they have 500 new features and not any of them are that big, but together it just makes the experience seem a lot nicer.
Totally. Exactly right.
All right. So what have you been able to use it so far?
Yes. So I was able to install it late last night and I've been able to use it throughout the day today. And I've got the first feature we'll talk about is Cortana. I guess that's the biggest. If you could point to one feature of the update, that's probably the one that has the most eyes on it, right? Everybody's wondering, what is Microsoft going to do with Apple having Siri and Google having Google Now?
Right.
And the answer is Cortana. And have we talked on the end user about Cortana before? Or
yeah, we mentioned it and we compared it to Siri and Google Now, and we said it could have some standout features that would differentiate itself from those two.
Yeah, and what's interesting, just at the highest level possible, is that it's kind of a mashup of both Siri and Google Now. So, for example, earlier today, Cortana popped up a notification in my new notification center, which we'll get to in a minute, and it said that there was a frost watch in effect in the area, and that is something that Siri doesn't do, right? Am I wrong about that?
I don't know. I've never asked Siri for a frost watch.
Well, see, that's the thing. So Google Now and apparently Cortana Now, you don't have to ask.
So it gives it to you as part of the weather?
Right. So you just get a notification and it says, hey, there's a frost watch. Look out.
Okay. Well, Siri doesn't give you notifications unless you ask for something.
Right, right. And there's the potential there for spam kind of opportunities, but and perhaps that's why Apple opted not to do that. But I mean,
Apple has notifications.
Right.
They're not voice based; they're visual, but that's just not part of how Siri works. Siri is an on-call assistant, but nothing that ever wakes up your phone for any reason.
Right. Right. So Google Now doesn't have that kind of personality that Siri has, right? So this is how Cortana is kind of mashing the two together. Is They're bringing the kind of personality, personal assistant kind of thing from Siri, and they're bringing that kind of push first.
Contextual updates.
Yeah, the contextual push to the notification right now without somebody asking, just because we know what they want already. You know, something like, oh, there's a traffic jam, you're going to be 10 minutes late to work. Now we're going to put a notification in your tray.
Right, that's interesting, because at least as an iOS user, my experience with Google Now is limited by having to use the app or the browser on my computer to get those notifications and those cards. And so I don't have that experience. I only get notifications through the Apple ecosystem. So I would never get contextual updates like that.
Right, right. So I think in the end, it's quite an interesting feature. You know, I am not the target market for this. So it's kind of hard for me to say whether or not it's useful, because I think the real useful scenario is when you're driving, and, you know, I'm not driving. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get the best use out of it. And we'll see. We'll see how I'm going to give it a shot, and I'm going to try to see, you know, if I have a use case for it. But for the most part, I'm around people all day. So, you know, it's kind of inappropriate for me to use voice control to do things like sending text message replies and that kind of thing. So I'm going to give it a try. You know, when I'm at home and I need to do something, I'll try to see if I can make it useful for my use case. But if you do have a commute and that kind of thing, and you are in the car often, I could see this being just a game changer for you as a Windows Phone user, at least, or as an iOS user and getting Siri. Same idea, right?
Sure, yeah. Any sort of voice recognition based interface is going to be huge for people in the car, but I'm looking forward to Apple's steps going beyond that with CarPlay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, certainly.
So if Cortana hasn't been that useful for you so far, it's only been a day, but what is your favorite new feature on Windows Phone 8.1?
So again, it's not really one thing, you know, it's a whole bunch of stuff that is interesting. If I've got to nail one feature down, it's got to be the overall snappiness of the device. And when I say snappiness, I am realizing that this is, in fact, a kind of psychological thing, right? So what I'm talking about is whatever they've done to tweak the animations that they've got on the device makes it feel faster, even if it's not.
It's funny that you're almost bashful to even mention something like that, but an Apple fanboy would take apart tiny tweaks in the animations all day. He would dig into the design behind them, and he would feel no shame. So I think having snappier feeling animations can definitely improve the experience of a UI.
Yeah, definitely. They've changed something about the way the start menu reappears when you come back to it. They've changed some stuff just about how you kind of move through the interface. They remember we talked about this when they unveiled their multitasking UI, how they've got the X in the upper right corner of each card of the app.
Right. Yeah.
And we said, well, that's stupid. They should swipe away. So they've added the fact that you can swipe down to close an app, and that makes a lot of sense.
Do they get rid of the X?
No, the X is still there just because it's discoverable, right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I think that makes some design sense. So for people who don't know to swipe down, the X is there and you can still click on it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've seen that in a lot of applications.
Right. So I think if I've got to nail one down, that has got to be the one. It's just the overall feel of it is kind of fresh and snappy. And I don't know if that'll wear off over time or not. We'll see.
I think I might have said swipe to close in the multitasking bar. I mean, if I still didn't have that on my iPhone, I would be dying to get it.
Yeah, definitely so. So, let's see. Where should we go in my list here? We've got the other thing. Oh, here, one last thing about Cortana that is kind of interesting. Unlike Google Now and unlike Siri, when you say something to Cortana, it in fact often does not go out to the internet to parse the text and do something with it.
Oh, really? So it's doing voice transliteration on your phone?
Some of it, yeah. So I was experimenting with turning the radios on and off and seeing what was available and what wasn't. So I said, Cortana, tell me a joke. And it said, oh, I'm sorry, the internet's not there. And I said, Cortana, play Built to Spill. And it fired up the radio and or it fired up the music app and played Built to Spill. So a lot of that stuff you're going to be able to use even without an internet connection.
That's interesting. So before the iPhone had Siri, they had that feature. You could play music or make phone calls or check your voicemail before there was Siri, using the same Siri voice. And when the iPhone 4S came out with Siri and you enabled it, you could no longer place phone calls or play music without the internet if you had Siri activated.
Right. And then when Apple took it over, they moved it into more of a cloud-centric kind of service.
Oh, no. This is all Apple. This is all Apple-built stuff. So by the time the iPhone 4S came out, that was Apple's launch of Siri as a built-in service.
Right, because I know when Apple got Siri, that was an acquisition, and then they basically removed some stuff and polished it a little and then released it under the Apple brand, right?
Right. So, but in the meantime, they had a non-Siri voice activation service that could parse speech and find the name, find music names or podcast names using the software directly on your phone.
Right.
But Siri sends everything to an Apple server that crunches the numbers efficiently as possible and sends it back to you.
Right. All right, well, if I had to pick a second one, it's definitely got to be the Action Center. And that is it's basically like Android in a way that you pull down from the top of the screen and you get some notion of a bunch of notifications that sit in this tray that you're able to dismiss. And you've also got some quick actions like turning off and on Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and that kind of thing. Again, that's kind of boring, right? But man, it's nice to have after not having it for a little while.
Sure, yeah. I mean, this looks a lot like the control center that Apple set up in iOS 7. But, you know, it's missing is a flashlight.
Yes, no flashlight. And, you know, this stuff is customizable. I bet you if I dig into here, there, in fact, will be a flashlight. Let me see. No flashlight. So there's camera and brightness and Bluetooth, location, even VPN, a bunch of other stuff. No flashlight. So
yeah, that flashlight in Control Center in iOS has been a really big one for iOS 7 for me.
Yeah, cool. So what is kind of interesting is that I think that the notification Windows Phone is done with a design flair that just you don't see in Android. It's things like when you get a notification and you swipe it off to the right, if it's a two-line notification, the bottom line moves slightly off to the right and then drags the first line along with it as you swipe it away. And then with that kind of animation, it gives you this sense of momentum in swiping it as opposed to just kind of swiping away at a rectangle. So that's kind of, you know, little tiny polish kind of things I think are kind of nice about it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nice. I have a hard time imagining what you're describing, but it sounds pretty and thought out.
All right, and let's talk a little bit about the Gmail integration. You're going to like this, Taylor. If you were to get Windows Phone, you now get the CardDAV and the CalDAV protocols implemented in Windows Phone. So,
part of the setup for just a regular Gmail account?
Yes, sir. Yes.
But I'm guessing they still don't have push mail.
So I'm not sure about this. I couldn't get to this before we started the show, but I've got my Gmail on here and it appears to be push. And I don't know if it's just polling often or if it is actually push, but it appears to me like it is in fact push. So I know.
Okay, well, if it is, that would be cool.
Yeah, I know that they have the contact and the calendar push now. And so Josh there in the chat is saying that the Gmail setup has an as items arrive setting. So that in fact means that it has push.
So, well, I just wonder how it's determining the items arrive because Gmail got rid of Exchange server support.
Right, it's not Exchange.
How is it being pushed?
No, it's no longer Exchange. It's one of the Gmail, again, I don't know if it's like MailDAV or something like that, but it's one of their kind of protocols that Windows Phone implemented.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so that's huge for people who live in both ecosystems, which is most people, right? I mean, there's not a person out there who 100%, 101% lives in the Microsoft ecosystem altogether. You know, you've got to have something out there that is not a Microsoft service. And I know now that I say that, we're going to get an email saying, I am the one that does this. But
all right, it's a heterogeneous one. So if we get more than two, then there will be trouble.
Yeah, then we'll know something's going on. But anyway, point being is that it's a heterogeneous world we live in, and people use Google, and it's nice to see that. It's nice to see that they gave that kind of care to implement some Google protocols to give their Windows Phone users the best experience possible. That's nice to see. So another one you're going to think is silly is they're finally splitting apart the notifications volume and the media playback volume.
Oh, I don't think that's silly. Apple has the same thing.
Yeah, no, I mean it's silly actually, that it wasn't there in the first place.
Ah, well, I hope that's implemented well, because it can be pretty tricky sometimes in iOS to control those two volumes separately.
Yeah, so this doesn't really matter to me a whole lot, because I always keep my phone on vibrate. I don't really see a reason to have a ringer on, in my use case of my phone at very least. But the way this is working is if you hit the volume control up, you get the play buttons for the media and that kind of thing. There's a little arrow in the upper right. If you click on that, then you get two independent controls for notification and for music playback. So, again, a little tiny thing that's just nice to have.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange that there would just be two volume controls right next to each other, but I guess it makes it pretty clear.
Yeah, they're two horizontal sliders on top of each other, if that's more clear.
Oh, it's clear. It's just strange.
So also, by default, the keyboard in Windows Phone is getting the kind of swipe feature where you, instead of tapping each letter, you kind of fly your thumb around the keyboard and then it'll kind of figure out what you were trying to say.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
that's the default now?
Well, no. So the keyboard is both the tapping and the swiping kind. So if you swipe, it works. And if you tap, it works.
That's pretty wild.
So I haven't really, I gotta see if it works for me. You know, I tried it and it did actually work. Like, it works correctly. I just don't know if I can get used to something that wacky. I know a lot of people love the swipe keyboard.
Yeah, but people who use Android, who use the swipe keyboard, they have decided their keyboard is terrible and switched over to a new one. So for existing Windows Phone users who've been using their keyboard for a while, to have a new option all of a sudden is kind of surprising. And I wonder how many people will switch over to the swiping way.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. You just have to realize that it's there, and then you can kind of give it a shot. So we'll see in the coming weeks if I end up using it. I'll try to give it an honest try. So I've got a couple of smaller ones that we'll get through quickly, and then I've got one larger one, and we can kind of move on from the Windows Phone 8.1. So they also have implemented VPN, so it's mostly for businesses, although if you are like me, then you have a server at home and that has VPN on it, and you can VPN into your home network to protect yourself at Starbucks, that kind of thing. So I know I've talked about it before. I wrote an article about how to set up the server so that you can VPN into your home network using Windows Home Server. And unfortunately, that kind of VPN is not going to work with Windows Phone. So they use a different authentication mechanism called IKEv2, which isn't what I wrote the article with. The article was using MSChap2. So
wait, so your Windows Home Server VPN platform that you have at your house doesn't work with your Windows Phone?
Right. And the reason is that at least I think this is the reason, the IKEv2 authentication mechanism requires that you, as a business, install a certification or a certificate on the device to use it. So I think they're really aiming it at businesses, and they're assuming that nobody else is really going to be using VPN, which may not be a correct assumption, because I know that there are plenty of people out there that read that article and liked the fact that they could use their home server with VPN in that way.
So how much more complicated is it to set up a VPN on your home server that supports this protocol?
So I'm not sure. I think I'll have to look into it, but I think what is going to have to happen is I'm going to have a cert on the device, on the Windows phone, that authenticates it to the server to use this protocol. So I'm not quite sure yet. I have to kind of dig in and figure it out.
Well, you know what? I bet those guys at the home server show will figure it out.
Yeah, maybe. They'll get to it before me, that's for sure. All right, and another tiny little feature is you can choose to have an extra column of tiles on your home screen. So right now you can have two medium-sized tiles next to one another. If you have a larger resolution phone, it might make sense to have an extra column. And what
right,
it does
so this is probably aimed at people with newer, larger Windows phones.
Yeah, probably. I tried it on mine, and it looks a little ridiculous. So I'm staying with it, and I think if you have a larger phone, then maybe you can take advantage of that. But I'm gonna stick with the two columns.
Well, that makes sense. There's no reason to go up unless you're running out of room or not using it properly.
All right, and this will be the last part of Windows Phone 8.1 that we talk about. They've removed the podcast feature from the OS.
Well, what do you mean they removed the feature from the OS?
Yeah, they just removed it. It's gone now.
So was it part of the music app?
Yes, it was part of the music's hub would be the...
Uh-huh. So why did they get rid of it?
So actually what they did, they didn't quite get rid of it. they made it into an app that you can now download, and it's just a separate Windows Phone app. I think the idea is that they're going to be able to update it a little more easily and a little more often than they would have otherwise.
Well, I know that's why Apple did it years ago, but it was a pretty unfortunate change for Apple because the separate podcast app was virtually unusable for over a year.
Yeah, and I've been using this throughout today, and I think it's definitely a young app. You know, I'm not sure I would call it unusable, although it's pretty close. So I was talking with Josh on Twitter earlier, and we were saying that there's no way to get a list of the most recently downloaded podcasts. And that happens to be how I consume podcasts.
Going into the store and getting a list?
No, so you have your subscriptions on the phone, and you get a list of the most recent podcasts that you've downloaded, and then the ones you kind of don't care about get pushed off to the end of the queue, and you don't just kind of let them go, and that's okay. So the closest I've come with this app, from what I've seen, unless I'm missing something, is if you go in, it gives you a list that is alphabetical, and it shows you how many new podcasts each podcast subscription has. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you still have to scroll through this list of podcasts when really what I want is show me, just sort this by newest downloaded.
Among all your podcasts.
Right.
I gotcha.
If I've got, let's say, Entertainment 2.0 in there and they published last night, I want to see it at the top of this queue.
Well, maybe you should write your own podcast app.
Yeah, maybe. I'll go work for Microsoft and we'll make this better. But anyway, I'm sure they'll kind of spiffy this up over time. I think overall they've done a pretty good job with the app. I'm liking what it's got. So this is the first time on Windows Phone we've got 1.5 and 2 times play for podcasts.
Yeah, those are nice. I like that. Does it have half speed play as well?
No, I don't. No half speed. Just 1.5 yeah. And two.
So Apple has 1, 1.5, 2.5. I don't know why anyone would ever use half-speed podcast playback, but it's available, and I have to cycle through it every time.
I listen to us for just a minute on the 2 times, and it's completely bonkers. I guess we talk a little faster than on most podcasts, but
I try to talk pretty fast. I aim for a 1 to 1.5 conversion ratio. I think 2 would be really crazy, but there are people who talk a lot faster than we do, and I've heard of people listening to them on 2 or even 3 speed.
Yeah, I like I said, I tried us on 2, and it was unlistenable. I tried some other shows on 1.5, and it was actually listenable. So I don't know. We'll see if I can get used to that. I'm not sure I can.
But think of how many more shows you could listen to
if
you did.
True. All right, so I think that will do it for our extended Windows Phone 8.1 wrap-up. We, by all means, did not cover everything in Windows Phone 8.1, although I think we did a pretty good job of getting the most major features in there. We've got some links in the show notes. If you really want to dig in, there's one in particular. It's called Windows Phone 8.1 Features over there at WP Central. And it just has the fire hose of all the features that are available in Windows Phone 8.1. And it's a pretty big list. Like I said, most of them are minor, but when you wrap them all together, I think this is an update that really brings Windows Phone forward into functional competitiveness with iOS and Android both. And that's definitely a good thing to see.
Cool. And there is even a video over at wmpoweruser.com showing all of the nifty little animations that Chris was talking about.
Okay, so that'll do it for Windows Phone 8.1 news. Let's talk about some of the devices. We'll move through this a little more quickly than we went through the Windows Phone features. But as part of the announcement of Windows Phone 8.1 and as part of the Build conference, Nokia has also released some devices. And they've got three of them. Starting at the bottom, there's the Lumia 630 and the 635. From what I can see, they're basically the same phone. They're both a 4.5-inch diagonal screen with 1.2 gigahertz Snapdragon 400 chips in there. The 630 has a dual SIM card slot and apparently does not have LTE. And the 635, in fact, has LTE. So those are the two low-end devices, seemingly to target Europe. I'm not sure what an American would do with the dual SIM.
Right. Seems like a low-end world phone aiming at people who want to have SIMs on two different networks.
Right. Definitely so. So, and then more interesting to us on the End User Podcast, we've got the flagship device, which is the Nokia Lumia 930. And that is a 5-inch screen. It's 441 pixels per inch. It's got a 20 megapixel per pure view camera on the back. And that's got the nearly the latest 2.2 gigahertz Snapdragon 800 processor in there. It's got 32 gig of storage and 2 gig of RAM, which is the basically the leading Android devices are this exact same phone at this point.
Well, this one seems to me like just a rebadging of the Lumia icon on Verizon.
Yeah, a little bit. It's very, very similar. So anyway, those are the devices. They all look kind of like Nokia devices. If you're interested in some more of the hardware aspects of it, we've got a couple links in the show notes. So have a look there, and let's move on to some Windows 8.1 update. That's right. They called it Windows 8.1 update, which
so
I thought
Windows
was very strange.
Windows 8.1 was already out. This is the update to Windows 8.1 that is also 8.1.
Right. So if they were more sane, they would have said this is 8.1.1 or 8.11 or 8.2, but instead they went for Windows 8.1 update in a flabbergasting attempt to confuse everyone in the world.
I expect nothing less.
So anyway, not to be too hard on it, the name's just a name, I guess, but
it's a lot better than the IntelliMouse Explorer 9000.
Right. They should have called it the IntelliMouse Explorer update. 12,000.
That would confuse so many people. They would think they would have to go out and get a new mouse.
Yeah, this is not compatible with old mice. Anyway, no, it's called Windows 8.1 update, for better or for worse, and they've added a bunch of features to 8.1 that are friendly to the desktop kind of users. So this is a pretty good update, I thought. I was on Entertainment 2.0 with Josh Pollard over there the other week, and we were kind of bagging on it. And I think now that I see it in action, it makes a little bit more sense for me.
Well, that's good. So what is it that that you like about it?
So when you are on the start screen, you can, in fact, right-click on something and pin it to the taskbar. So they're kind of relating the desktop and the start screen together in ways that I think makes a lot of sense. So, for example, if you're on a touch device, you don't have right-click. You have long hold actions. And when you're on a touch device, nothing changes. It's still the same old thing that happens when you long press on it. But if you are in a laptop and desktop situation, you can right-click on something and pin it to the taskbar, which I think makes some sense. And then when you go in to use the desktop, if you launch a Metro app from the taskbar, then the taskbar stays persistent at the bottom, and it actually hides itself, kind of like the OS X dock hides itself. And you get some of the niceties of the desktop with some of the niceties of Metro. And what they've also gone ahead and done is they added a little underscore and X to the top right of the app. When you mouse up to the top, a title bar appears, and you get a minimize and max and close function. And on the upper left, you get a split right and split left menu that you can click on. So I think it's a halfway decent way of doing this.
Yeah, those all sound like nice implementations. It all makes sense to me.
They're kind of diluting what their original vision for Metro was, and I think they realized that they had to do that because people were just plain uncomfortable using it.
Yeah, which is too bad. I thought it was nice.
I thought it was nice too, and I think just everyone else out there who didn't think it was nice completely overwhelmed us. So what they're also adding is for people who are using non-touch devices, they're adding a power button back to the start screen. So instead of swiping in on the charms and clicking settings and getting to power, right in the upper right next to your username, there's a little power button where you can shut down, sleep, restart, and apply updates and that kind of stuff that you're used to from the start menu. And lastly, they added a boot to desktop option. Now, I haven't gone in and tried this, but there is an advanced startup option menu. And apparently, hidden underneath that menu requires a restart, so I haven't done this yet. But apparently, there is a way to boot straight to desktop hidden in that menu, which requires a reboot. So apparently, also, the OEM is going to be able to set that by default. So if OEMs need to, and they want to, and they think that that's the right thing for their users, they can boot to desktop by default.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. And yeah, some people are definitely going to want to do it, and they'll probably know if they want to boot to desktop every time. It's weird that it requires a restart just to set the setting, though.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with that. I mean, maybe they don't want you to do that, but at least it is an option for the people that want to do that. For me, it doesn't really bother me that much, but I know a lot of people are really hung up on that.
Right. Well, it sounds like overall, good news for users of Windows 8. Is the update available already?
Yes. Yeah. If you go to Windows Update, it'll download right there for you.
All right, cool. So not so good news for the 28% of internet users that are still using Windows XP. It is officially no longer supported publicly by Microsoft, although apparently a number of high-profile companies and organizations will be paying Microsoft for private security updates continuing into the future. If you are someone who's not affiliated with one of these companies and you're using Windows XP, you will not have access to any of these updates. So your copy of Windows XP will become increasingly insecure as time goes on. And you should think about upgrading or getting rid of it.
What's worse is that they released the updates for Windows 7 and 8, and that gives everybody the tip of the hat to know that there is an exploit there. So then they can go attack XP with the things that are being updated in 7 and 8.
Oh, really? Not necessarily for every update, but probably a lot of them are.
Yeah, a lot of it is shared, yes. So yeah, certainly not every single update, but some of them are shared. So definitely not too good. And I think we'll be fine. I think there are plenty of older systems running out there. There are like Windows Server 2000 whatever boxes running out there. And, I think if you personally know anybody running XP, you should probably recommend that they upgrade. And for people who really know what they're doing and they don't do high-risk things, then they can keep running it. But, for For your average user, I don't think it makes sense to be using XP anymore. And frankly, Windows 7 is so much easier to use. I guess there is some learning curve to it, but I don't see any reason to be running XP anymore. Now, the business side of things is a little different because they have a substantial cost to upgrade from XP to Windows 7. And that is a non-trivial problem. And unfortunately, a lot of businesses are caught with their pants down. They should have done the work a couple years ago. They didn't. They put it off, and now they have to pay a premium for support. So that was a wise financial decision by many businesses out there. And that is indeed sarcasm, if you could not detect it.
Well, not sarcastically, I have come across a few use cases of individuals who have instances of Windows XP running. Now, because a lot of my business is with Macs, these are people who are running Windows XP on virtual machines on their Macs. And those, fortunately, can be protected and firewalled pretty well in most instances. And so I am hoping and expecting those to be secure for the time being. Although I did tell them that we should start thinking about an upgrade path.
Yeah, and, you know, if you really only use it for very specific things, then that's fine. But if you are using it day-to-day and checking email and surfing the web and clicking links and stuff like that, then you definitely want to not do that.
Right. But if you are not using it on the internet at all, then that's pretty secure.
Yeah, then that's probably fine. If
it's actually disconnected.
Or if you have a virtual machine and you're using it to use some obscure accounting software or something like that, then that's okay. You can keep doing that. Just don't surf the internet on it.
Yep.
All right, well, let's get out of Windows news for the first time in the podcast, I believe. Let's get on to the Amazon Fire TV. What do we got here?
All right, so almost 2 weeks ago, Amazon finally announced that they are launching a set-top box called the Fire TV. And so this is a direct competitor to Apple TV and Roku, and it's pretty similar in size. It's a very nondescript black square. It comes with just a power cable and a remote. And it's a pretty good piece of equipment.
Yeah, I love the hardware of it. It's just a black box. It's got a simple kind of black, shiny, recessed logo on the top that says Amazon. I think it's absolutely beautiful. Totally minimalistic and beautiful.
Yeah, minimalistic, but very powerful and fairly easy to repair. So they put a lot more powerful hardware in here than Roku or Apple TV because they want this to be a game-centric device on top of media consumption. So it's got Hulu, Netflix, plenty of apps, and I'm sure that they'll keep adding more apps, but it wants to be an Android game box and marketplace hosted by Amazon.
Right, and honestly, I don't know if that is going to be a reality. I think there are just devices that, albeit more expensive, are just going to be a better gaming machine. And if you try and make this kind of box, I think gaming is second fiddle, right? It's not the primary purpose of the box. And as such, it's just not going to be quite as good an experience. You know, maybe they'll get some Angry Birds or whatever, but I can't imagine that gaming would be the reason why you would get this box.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is they've decided to make this pairable with Xbox 360 and PlayStation 4 game controllers. So I'm not quite sure if you had a PlayStation 4, why you would want to use your controller on a $99 Android box instead. But you could, and that's kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess you could. I'm not sure who would want to, but I guess you could if you want to. What's a little more interesting, I think, is the voice control. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the first set-top box with Sirius voice control, and it works reasonably well. It's pretty good at finding videos and games and music, etc., that's hosted by Amazon that you would then buy from them. But it doesn't always work that well, and the algorithms are not quite where you would expect them to be able to use it as your primary interface.
Right. So I don't know. I think that's the most interesting thing they've done on this is having the voice control and just the user experience of what's on the screen looks pretty nice to me.
It does. My only problem with the main interface is that it puts that proprietary Amazon content that you usually have to pay for, it puts that right in front. And to access subscription services like Hulu and Netflix, it's less convenient to find and get to them.
Yeah.
And they're not supported at all by the microphone search.
Well, I think if you could find one knock about this, that's probably going to be it, is this is a box that's designed to get Amazon content in front of you. And if you're not taking that path, they're not going to make it quite as easy for you. So, you know, buying a box like this from Amazon and using Amazon services, that's a lot of lock-in to swallow. So, you know, you don't get that with the likes of, Roku. You don't get that. I guess you get it a little bit with Apple TV, but you know, there's all kinds of integration on Apple TV that are pretty compelling. And I just feel like by getting this device, I'm wedding myself to the single content stream that is Amazon. And they've got other apps for it, but it just seems like, it would be hard to get along with this without an Amazon Prime subscription. That makes me a little uncomfortable.
I wonder if and when this device will be hacked in any useful way.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's pretty generic hardware. You could probably get in there and put whatever you want on there.
Yeah, it's basically running a quad-core Snapdragon 600 processor.
All right, I'll be excited when they get Media Center on there.
Yeah, or XBMC, that could be cool.
Sure, that can do in a pinch. All right, well, let's get into our, that'll do it for our stories this week. Let's get into our tip of the week before we get out of here. What do you got for us up front here?
Okay, so this is a Heartbleed-related tip of the week. So we mentioned that if your website that you want to check for Heartbleed or change the password hasn't been patched yet, then changing your password won't really do much good. It might not. But you would want to be sure before you changed it. And so we have two websites where you can test to find out whether the patch has been implemented yet, which version of SSL it's using, and whether the patch affects the site.
Right, and the second one is from SSL Labs, and they have the ability to give you all kinds of SSL diagnostics. Heartbleed is just one of them. So if you're a little more technical and you can handle that and you're not just looking for Heartbleed, SSL Labs has a bunch of really useful stuff. So I figured I'd pass that along too.
Right. So one will just tell you if there are any problems with the website, yeah. And the other will give you a full analysis so that you can make a more comprehensive decision about your security related to that site.
One is basically for end users and one is for a more technical background, you know, developers and sysadmins, that kind of thing.
Okay, good. We have both.
Yeah, and I'm sure we have both listening. So whoever you are, we got you covered. So let's get into our hybrid green tech story of the week and our kicker. What do you have for us? This looks cool.
Yeah, this seemed like the perfect hybrid green kicker. And this is the
Gricker.
Last week's unveiling of the Solar Impulse 2. Now, last year, we had mentioned the Solar Impulse plane, the first solar-powered aircraft that could fly all night just based on how much its solar banks had charged the previous day. And so it could continue flying into the next day when it starts recharging. Now, the Solar Impulse 2 is the craft that they eventually plan to circumnavigate the globe. And it has the wingspan of a 747 and the weight of an average sedan.
And you gotta look at the picture of this thing to get the scale of what it is.
It's it almost reminds me of the Spruce Goose.
What's the Spruce Goose?
Oh, it was a gigantic wooden airplane that barely made it off the ground before it crashed. It was one of those flight barons of the 20th century tried to build the biggest plane ever.
Yeah. Yeah, it does bear some resemblance. I'm looking at the Google images now. It does have some resemblance there.
Was it Howard Hughes? I think it was Howard Hughes tried to build this Bruce.
Hopefully it doesn't have a resemblance in performance.
No, hopefully not. So this is pretty cool. It's relatively big for a solar-powered plane in terms of the cabin. It is big enough to fit two pilots and their supplies enough for them to be able to make trans-Pacific flights, which will take an estimated 5 days because it can only go about 85 miles per hour top speed.
Right, right. Yeah, it's got to go slow because it can't burn that much fuel, which is batteries in this case.
Yep, that's right. The batteries have to be super efficient there, and it has four 17.5 horsepower engines running at 97% efficiency.
Wow. Yeah. So you need that to have this kind of work with the weight of batteries and that kind of thing.
Right. You want it to be as light as possible.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, if you want to have a look, we've got, we have a link in the show notes to it. And you can see the gigantic wing filled with solar panels. It's a pretty cool sight to see. So, Taylor, let's get out of here, and if somebody had to contact you over the internet in some way, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they would build a solar-powered plane and and fly it around the world and send updates, which I would certainly read.
All right. And,
so that would be a great way. Another way, which I probably would pay attention to, is if you were to get at me on Twitter. I am at TaylorPhone.
And if you wanted to get at me, there is no solar plane required. You can tweet at me at Chris Hale Barnes. So that'll do it for this week. Let's get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.